Well, we are returning today to our study through the book of Job. So if you would turn to Job chapter 38. This is the beginning of four chapters in which God speaks personally to Job. Job has been asking for this, and now it's become a reality. Up to this point, Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have taken turns talking with Job and giving their thoughts on why he was suffering like he was. Their understanding is that Job is being punished for something that he did. He's being punished for sins that he committed. They accuse him of living a hypocritical life. Job consistently denied this. He knew that this was not true. He didn't understand why he was suffering, but he knew that it was not because of sin that he had committed beforehand. And he asked God for the opportunity to present his case before God, because he's confident, he said, that if I can just present my case before God, then I'll be found not guilty. Well, after this, after the three friends and Job finished their discourses back and forth, another friend comes into the picture by the name of Elihu. Elihu is younger than the other men. He has a tendency to kind of get carried away when he speaks. But Elihu shared some things that were different from what the other friends had to say. And they were things that really helped prepare Job for the point that we are now, when God actually does speak with Job. So with that in mind, let's read the first three verses of chapter 38 and see how the Lord begins his words to Job. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. So we see, first of all, here that God spoke to Job out of the whirlwind. Now, the whirlwind is interesting for several different reasons. First off, the idea of whirlwinds and storms is the last thing that Elihu spoke of in chapter 37. That was the very that was the last part of his final discourse to Job. He spends a lot of time. Really, he spends the whole chapter of chapter 37 talking about thunder, lightning, snow, downpours of rain, thick clouds. That's what he's talking about. And when Elihu talks about those things, he's using those as examples of how God speaks. So it's not just thunder within itself. He spoke of the thunder of God's voice. He says, the Lord thunders with his majestic voice. He says something like that two or three times in chapter 37. And then we see now in chapter 38, when God does speak, he speaks out of a storm. He speaks out of a whirlwind. Now, this would be a loud storm. But it's interesting, Job has no problem at all hearing the voice of the Lord very clearly, which emphasizes for us this the might, the power, the authority of God's word over all else. It's also interesting to note that God's done this at other times, or did this at other times with other men. Whenever he was speaking to Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapter 1, and he gives him a vision that Ezekiel's to take down and apply and so forth and speak to the people. A whirlwind precedes the vision before God, that God gives to Ezekiel. He does the same thing to Elijah. So this is something that God, a way that God chose to speak to people in other times as well. So we see here God did not speak in a small, quiet voice. He spoke loudly. He spoke dramatically. And before we look at what God actually said, we need to think about how Job was prepared to hear what God was going to say. And that takes us back to Elihu. So the next point, Elihu prepared Job to see that God was not dealing with him out of anger, but out of love. This was important because Job had become convinced. I mean, he could not understand what was happening, and it's like he's wrestling with God and trying to come to grips with what's going on with him, what God is all about, what are God's purposes in this. He didn't know why these were happening, and so he concluded, God must be angry with me. He didn't know why he was angry, but he felt like God was pursuing him, like he was out to get him, in a sense. Well, Elihu helped Job see something that the other men didn't emphasize. Elihu helped Job see that trials are not necessarily brought in this life to punish us. That can happen. But it's not always true. Often God brings difficulties in our life to get our attention. He works to teach us things in certain ways that we would never really hear it otherwise if it did not come in the context of a difficult trial or in the context of suffering. And so, in other words, God is not addressing Job. He doesn't address us. He's not addressing us, especially as his children, out of anger. He's addressing us out of love because the trials are meant to train us, to teach us, to discipline us for our good. And that was an important thing for Job to recognize. And it seemed like recognizing this really made a difference for Job. We're kind of making a presumption here based on silence in a sense, but whenever Elihu would share, and he stopped, I think three different times, if I remember right now, to see if Job or anybody had anything to say. Nobody said anything. When the other guys had spoken, Job always took an opportunity to respond to them. Oftentimes he had to defend himself, to clarify or even disagree with some of the things that they had said. When Elihu speaks, Job never responds. Job never says anything. And it seems as if that Job understood that Elihu was presenting some things in here, not in always in the best way, but he was presenting some things to Job that were important for Job to understand. And so it seems that Job was able to recognize that God was dealing with him as a friend, not as an enemy, which made all the difference in how Job was understanding what was going on with him. And it made all the difference, I think, in how he was able to receive what God has to say when God does speak to him. And that idea really helps us to understand as well what God was doing. I thought this was a very fascinating quote by William Henry Green. He said, "God is the sovereign Lord of all, accountable to no being but himself. He does not appear to vindicate himself, but to rescue Job." See, when God speaks to Job, he does not offer any explanation for what's happening to Job. He doesn't answer any of his questions. He makes no attempt to justify what he has allowed to take place in Job's life. None. Like I said, he doesn't answer Job's questions. What God does is he begins to just throw out question after question after question to Job. And the point here is that God has no obligation to give us an account of what he does and why he has done it and why he doesn't do some things. He has no obligation to explain to us what he's done. And he doesn't. So he is not coming here to justify himself. He is not coming here to vindicate himself against false accusations. He doesn't have to do that. He's the sovereign one. What he has done, he is coming here in the storm to rescue Job. Remember, Job is enduring assaults from Satan. Especially, Satan shows up, especially in the first couple chapters. You know the test that he brings. First, the stealing of all his property, destroying of all his property, the killing of his 10 children. And then, of course, Satan is instrumental as the one that brings in the physical suffering that comes as well, the boils, everything, all the physical suffering that Job endures. And I think you'd have to say, even though Satan's name does not come up here, was behind in a sense, at least in a very in a sense, the discussions that he was getting from his friends, because he was not getting any help from his friends. His friends were making it worse, overwhelmingly making it worse. Well, Job has been enduring these assaults from Satan. And he won. Job won. Now, he struggled. He struggled mightily. But Satan did not prevail. Satan has failed. And so with God beginning to speak now, the assault is over. The assault from Satan is over now. God has come to rescue. He's here to rescue his servant. It's interesting to note in verse 1, it says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." The word there for Lord is the word Yahweh. That's the first time, and God has been spoken of often throughout the book of Job. This is the first time the word Yahweh is used as God's name. And Yahweh is known as God's covenant name. And so there's a sense where there's an acknowledgement here that God is not going to allow his covenant child, his covenant servant, to falter. He's here to rescue him. So it's the Lord, Yahweh, who has come to rescue Job at this point. Another thing we need to note. Job withstood the accusations of Satan, but God had greater purposes than this for him. As we said, Satan failed. He accused Job of serving God only because of all the good stuff God gave him and the fact that God would not let bad things happen to Job. And so Satan says, "God, if you allow hard trials into Job's life, then Job will curse you." Satan did everything he could to make that happen, to make Job curse him, and he failed. But we need to recognize here that that's not the only purpose God had in mind for these trials. It wasn't just simply so that Job could withstand and prove Satan wrong. I mean, that's a part of it, obviously. That shows up at the very beginning. But it doesn't begin and end with that. There's more to it. God had so much more in mind for Job in these trials than just him proving that Satan was wrong, proving those accusations wrong. For example, there are things that Job has come to understand in these trials that he never would have recognized otherwise. One of the most important things he saw as he was appealing to God, just presenting his case, trying to wrestle with what's going on, Job came to realize, I need an advocate. I need a redeemer. I need someone who will be a mediator between me and God in this. And so he recognized the need for that. He had a revelation here, an understanding of the Redeemer, an understanding of the Lord Jesus Christ, that he understood that he needed that. And it was in the process of these wrestlings, in the middle of his trials, that he came to understand that a very important reality. That was just a monumental understanding, you know, on Job's part. Job also was a man who lived in the fear of the Lord. I mean, that was emphasized, you know, a number of times early on in the book. And so Job was well aware that God is constantly at work in the lives of people, the lives and the affairs of nations. But in these trials, there were things going on that Job could not comprehend, that he did not understand what God was up to. And so, as we just mentioned, Elihu helped him see an aspect of God's work that Job had not seen clearly before, that God works out of discipline oftentimes to get attention to teach in ways that are, you're going to learn best oftentimes in some of those difficult times. And now we're at the point where God very graciously speaks to Job. Very likely there was no one around Job who had ever had this kind of experience before. No one who had ever had God come and speak to them like God came and spoke to Job. I mean, this is a mercy in itself that the sovereign Lord of the universe would speak directly to one man. So that in itself was a mercy. But also, Job is going to see things about the majesty of God. He had a fear of the Lord, like we said. But he's going to see things about the majesty of God that he had never seen before. I mean, there's an insight that he's going to understand, which is going to radically change his life once he sees and understands these things. So God had greater purposes in mind for Job than just making sure he withstands these accusations of Satan. He was looking for this to be a time of greater growth and maturity in Job's life. And that's the same as for all of our trials. Now, one of the main things that God reveals in these next four chapters when he speaks is this. God is fully qualified to govern with unquestioned sovereignty. We can see from the very beginning of God's words here that this is going to be a major theme of what he has to say. Look again at verse 2 and 3. God says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me." One thing that's clear here, Job is only a man. God is God. And so God makes that clear from the very beginning. You're a man, I'm God. Job had been asking questions, really even making demands of God, out of ignorance and out of presumption. He had never let go of his faith, but he was beginning to make some demands of God that he really should not have. Like we said, God is not going to answer Job's questions, but instead he's going to pepper Job with a series of questions. In these next four chapters, 38, 39, 40, and 41, there are over 70 questions that God asks Job, and Job really doesn't answer any of them. So, God tells Job, he says, "Job, I want you to buck up. I want you to brace yourself for what's coming." So, from the very beginning, God's making it clear that he is fully qualified to govern with unqualified sovereignty. And so, he's going to make that very clear now to Job. Okay, let's begin now to work our way through the chapter. Through asking question after question, we're going to see in this chapter that God displays his sovereign majesty in his inanimate creation. From verses really 4 through 38, God speaks of varied aspects of the physical world that he has created and things that he continues to sustain in creation. Now, the things he refers to are things that, for the most part, are not living. It's not the living aspect of his creation. Beginning in verse 39 and then into the later chapters is when he's going to get into that. So we'll stop at verse 38 this morning. But let's begin by looking at verses 4 through 7. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" In these verses, we see that God rules over the earth. God rules over the earth. He pictures the earth as if it were a building. And he says, "Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Who set up the measurements?" He says, "Job, can you explain how God suspends the earth in midair? Can you explain that?" Of course he can't. Job was not in existence when God created the earth. And then he speaks of the morning stars in verse 7, which is he's actually speaking of angels there. And it's a reference to how the angels rejoiced as they observed creation. So creation of the earth is something only God can do. God rules over the earth. Look now at verses 8 through 11. "Or who enclosed the sea with doors when bursting forth it went out from the womb? When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. And I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop." Here we see that God rules over the sea. He rules over the sea. God is the one who determines the boundaries of the sea. The oceans cover about 70% of the earth's surface, and they are huge and intimidating. But God makes it clear that he determines exactly where they will be and how far they will extend. He's the one who determined the boundaries of the oceans. It's interesting. He speaks of making a cloud a garment and thick darkness like a swaddling band, he says, for the oceans. The swaddling band idea is it's the same as like we think of when you think about how Mary wrapped Jesus in swaddling clothes. It's blankets, little blankets that you would wrap up a newborn baby in. So it's interesting, God is using the picture of wrapping up a newborn little baby. He said, that's what I do to the oceans. The oceans are like my little baby. and I just wrap them up and I take care. I'm Lord over the oceans. He's in complete control of the oceans. Verses 12 through 15. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. In these verses, God makes it clear that He rules over the sun. He rules over the sun. God asks Job, have you ever commanded a new day to begin? Are you the one, have you ever made a statement and say, okay, now it's time for the day to end, and it will end? He said, whenever the sun rises for a new day, it gives clarity to what the earth looks like. In verse 14, it's like a document written on a clay tablet. And the surface is changed of that document when you roll a seal over the clay tablet, the document that was in that. He said, he's using that as an example. He says, when the light of day comes up, everything has been dark, you begin to see the ground and all the different aspects of the landscape in a different way, because the light brings it out where you can't see it when it's dark. And in these verses, God also points out not only that He is in charge of the day, sunrise, sunset, all the different aspects of that, but He also points out about how He providentially uses that, how God providentially uses the light of day. And He uses it to limit what wicked people can do. The Bible often mentions, and we even know this just by what we know of the world, is that oftentimes crimes, things that people would do that are wrong, they oftentimes wait for it to be nighttime to do that. So it's not as obvious. Feel like they have a better chance of getting away with it. Well, God says, and He talks about that when the light of day comes, they're not as active in those same kind of deeds because they can't do it under the cover of darkness. God says, I'm responsible for that reality. I'm responsible for the fact that those who intend to do harm are limited in what they can do in the daylight hours. He said, that's my providential work. Look now at verses 16 through 18. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Here we see God rules over the deeps, the deeps. A couple different deeps that He speaks of here. First, God asked Job whether he's ever walked at the deepest recesses of the oceans. The deepest recesses of the sea. The oceans average, this is just the average, 2 to 3 miles in depth. And they can go much deeper than that. So he's saying, have you ever walked on the bottom of the ocean? Have you ever done that? Well, God is completely aware and familiar with everything that is on the ocean floor, even at its deepest levels. Can anybody else make that claim? Another aspect of the deeps that God refers to here, He talks of death. Does Job understand all of the issues related to death and dying and what takes place there? And he doesn't understand all of that. That's really one of Job's concerns here, is he doesn't understand what was going on, what happens, you know, all the things that happen related to death. But God, of course, is intimately acquainted with all that. And then God speaks of the vast expanses of the earth as He describes it. And obviously there was much of the earth that Job knew nothing about, but it seems like it's not just all the things he didn't know about, but there's also enigmas and mysteries in the earth that Job and many of us in general have no clue about, on what those things are all about and why they happen and how they happen. But of course all those things are perfectly clear to God. There are no mysteries to God. Okay, verses 19 to 21. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the path to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. So here we see God rules over the light. He rules over the light. Where does light come from? How did it come into existence? If you're familiar with Genesis 1, you know that God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. I don't know if you're aware of this, but He created light before He created the sun. So there was light before there was a sun. So He's saying, Job, where's light come from? And where does it go when darkness comes? Where does the light go? And then He says in verse 21, He says, of course, I know you know all the answers to all these questions. You were already born when the world was created, right, Job? You've been here from the very beginning. You know everything, right? Of course, only God is eternal. Only God existed before the creation of the world. Verses 22 to 24. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle? Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? So here we see God rules over the snow. He rules over the snow. God asked Job if he knows where snow and hail come from. And it's the idea that they come oftentimes, especially snow and hail at different times in other categories, where it seems like there should be a big storehouse where it can all be stored before it's dumped, before it comes, you know, on the earth. And once again, God speaks of how He uses the snow, how He uses the hail. It's not just the reality of snow, but He talks about how He Himself uses the snow and for His own providential reasons. He says He uses it for great battles. There's an example of that in Joshua chapter 10. And it talks about how God uses the hailstones, used hailstones to fight against the Canaanites in a particular battle there. And from the way that's said, that's not the only time He's done those kind of things. There are times that God has specifically caused snow to fall or hail to come to determine and influence the outcome of a battle. So these are not just the fact, He's not just saying, I'm in charge of the weather and I'm in charge of the snow. He's saying, I have purposes behind when that snow comes and when it doesn't come. Okay, verses 25 to 28. Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land without people, or on a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the seeds of grass to sprout? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? So here we see God rules over the rainstorms. God is the one who opens a path for the thunderstorms. He decrees when rain will come. He decrees where the rain will go. He says He even causes it to rain in places where there's no people to profit from the rain, at least directly profit from the rain. And one thing that tells us that God's purposes don't center around man. God's purposes center around His glory and what honors Him most. Then God asks, He says, if the rain or the dew have a father, you know, where do they come from? And of course, it's not Job or any other person who can cause it to rain or can cause the dew to come on the grass. It's only God that can make that happen. He rules over these things. Verse 29 and 30. From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. So God rules over the ice. He says, who gives birth to the ice? Who gives birth to frost when it comes? It's God who determines when water will freeze over. So, God rules over common things like falling temperatures to the point that water will freeze. God's sovereign over that, over every aspect of the weather. Verse 31 to 33. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens, or fix their rule over the earth? God actually mentions four different constellations here. Pleiades, Orion, the bear, and some versions like mine have the word constellation in verse 32. Literally, that's the word, that's a Hebrew word, Maseroth, which may have been an ancient name for another constellation. So He seems to mention four different constellations of stars. And, of course, these are groupings of stars that from the earth appear to be fairly close together and are in different patterns. In reality, they are light years apart from each other. And he talks about the laws that regulate the stars and the planets, that those are all ordained by God. He is the one who has fixed them in the place where they are. So he rules over the stars. Finally, look at verses 34 to 38. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? So these verses make it clear that God rules over the clouds. He says, Job, can you call the clouds to come and produce rain at your command? Can you control the lightning? Can you count the clouds? Can you cause rain to come in a time of drought? Only God can do those things. One of the things, if you remember, 2012 was known for, we had tremendous times of drought. Man can't make rain come. That's in the hands of God. And so God is the one who rules over these things. Now, these verses are set up, like I said, are filled with questions. And you do not get any indication that Job even attempted to give an answer to anything. He's overwhelmed by really just simple questions about everyday things. Things that, you know, we probably just take for granted. But these are all things that God is constantly ruling over with his supreme wisdom. And that brings us to our third point. God taught Job some very important lessons. And I want to focus on two in particular this morning. The first lesson is this. No one can expect to fully understand all that God is doing in the world. The things that God presents to Job are not great theological questions like, where does evil come from? Or explain the Trinity, like Kevin did such a good job leading us in a discussion of that in our Sunday school class this morning. But that's not the kind of theological question. I mean, that's not what he presents. He says, Job, think about rain. Think about clouds, snow, hail, sunrise, sunset, the ocean. I mean, just everyday kind of things, the dew when it comes. He said, just look at the things that you're familiar with, the things that you see in the world. Can you explain that stuff, Job? Do you understand those things? It doesn't take hard questions to stump us. It doesn't really take a real hard question to get us to a place where we think, well, I can tell you a little bit, but I can't tell you the whole thing, whole answer to that. Now, these are areas where people study. I mean, some of these would fall into categories of oceanography, cartography, astronomy, meteorology. We study those kind of things, rightfully so. That's an aspect of God, so we're supposed to take dominion over this world. And we're supposed to learn and understand and those kind of things. And people have come to learn much and could actually give some level of an answer to some of these things now because of things that have been learned. But there's still much to learn in every one of those areas. That's why they still do research in all those areas. There's still so much to learn. But I think it's important to realize here, God is not just saying that he knows more than anyone else. He's not just saying that he understands it all. He's saying he controls it all. He decrees what does and does not happen and when it happens. I mean, the fact that we had the beginning of a day, we had a sunrise today, was because of God's decree that that would take place. It's not Mother Nature that makes that happen. It's God who makes that happen. He decrees these things. By his providential work, he causes all these wonders of nature that we can easily just kind of take for granted. He causes them to continue to function as he ordained them to function. And the point here that he's making is that if we can't understand completely, and in many ways not at all, some of the basic functions of the earth, how do we think we can understand what God is doing in a comprehensive way in the world? He revealed things in his word And we're responsible for what the Word says. And so the things He's revealed to us, we're responsible for it to understand. And so we can understand those things. And we're held accountable to understand those things. But there are also things that God does that we have very little idea of why He's done it and why He's doing it, what He has in mind. And not only are we limited in our understanding, we're limited in our ability to control things. Most of us have it in us, at least to a point, probably some more than others, to try to control things, to try to keep everything under, you know, just the way it's supposed to be. But you can only do that so much. You are not in charge. You are not in control. There are some ways we're in charge if you have authority. But you can, there's all kinds of things that come in that mess up your plans that you can't control. And so God's trying to get across here that we need to be able to trust Him. I saw a quote just this past week reminding us of the fact that we're not even privy to what's going on in our own hearts. I mean, you think if you know anybody, you know yourself, right? I saw a quote this week from John Piper. He said, God is doing probably 10,000 things in your life right now, and you may be aware of three of them. You don't even know what He's doing in your life. How do you know what's going on in the world? Like I said, there are things that we can understand because of what has been revealed to us in Scripture. But we also have to realize there are limits to what we can understand. And that causes us to come to the place of just saying, Lord, I'm content to trust You. You're in charge. You're sovereign over snow. So that means You're sovereign over my life. You're sovereign over Ohio. You're sovereign over the United States of America. You're sovereign over this world. I don't understand everything. I thank You for the things You've revealed to me. But at the same time, I have to trust You. I just have to trust You. Very important lesson. And especially comes into play when we're in trials and suffering. When it's hard and it hurts. And we don't know why. You may have some understanding of why. To a point. But you're not going to get the whole picture. And as we see here, God doesn't even owe you the explanation of everything. But you have to trust Him that what He's doing is good and what He's doing is wise. Second main lesson, I think, is this. Humility is essential to Christian growth. I have no doubt that the effect of all these questions directed toward Job from God was to make Job feel very humble. He was no longer thinking that if God would just show Himself, then I'll argue my case before God and everything. I mean, I think all that stuff was way out of it. I'm sure at this point Job's saying, why did I ever say that? I mean, instead, I think Job is probably just kind of almost thinking, I wish there was just some place I could kind of hide. But humility is good. Humility is a good thing. It's one of the most important characteristics in our life. I mean, it makes us willing to learn. If you're not humble, nobody can teach you anything. But humility makes you teachable. Humility helps us to admit when we've failed, not give an excuse for everything or blame somebody else because of what you did. Humility is willing to admit that we've failed. It makes us willing to admit that we are incapable of doing what God requires us to do. We need help. And I think you could say humility is essential in the Christian life in at least two ways. You might could expand it, but I think we can sum it up in two ways. First off, humility is necessary to even become a Christian. Because to become a Christian, you have to admit that you're a sinner. Lots of people don't want to admit that. You have to admit that you can never measure up to God's standard. It's not good enough just to say, well, nobody's perfect. That's an excuse. Nobody is perfect, but you can't measure up. None of us can. Therefore, that's humbling to admit that we cannot do what God says we're supposed to do. Even if you go through and actually do it, your heart is oftentimes not going to be where it should be in the process. We can't measure up. We have to admit that. We have to admit that we are weak and helpless on our own. To really change our life. We have to admit that only Jesus Christ can save us Only He can deal with us, can really deliver us from our sin. Only He can save us. And you also have to humbly submit yourself to Jesus Christ as your Lord, as your King. Which, once again, when you submit to Him, not only as your Savior, but as your King, as your Lord, you're admitting, I have messed things up big time, and I'll keep messing up if you're not the Lord of my life. That's humility. That's saying, Lord, I need help. You've got to have that. You've got to humble yourself before the Lord to even come to the Lord. And just admit all these things. So that's the first important aspect of humility in the Christian life. The second is just, it's just necessary for growth. Humility is necessary to grow as a Christian. I mean, the Bible tells us it's pride that goes before a fall. Pride that leads to destruction. So, the Bible also says that God is opposed to the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. We want grace. We need grace. And grace and humility go together. James 4, verse 10 says, if we will humble ourselves before the Lord, He will exalt us. J.I. Packer said it this way, very simple quote. He says, Christians grow greater by getting smaller. Christians grow greater by getting smaller. So may the Lord help us to humble ourselves before Him, to trust Him, no matter what's going on in our lives. Lord, we thank